Hello, everybody, and welcome to Verbal Shenanigans, episode 224, and this is a good one. We've had some real good ones in the last couple of weeks, and listenership's been up, so thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you for sharing, and thank you for, of course, joining us weekly here on the show. Now, we got a good one here, but we also have two great sponsors that help us on this show. One of them is Wolf Nation, WULF. That is Wake Up, Live Free Apparel. Wolf Nation just really makes some nice clothing for men, women, children. They just released a whole bunch of new things, hoodies and snapback hats, leggings. You got to go check them out. That is Wolf Nation Apparel. Wake up, live free. It's only a dream if you aren't pursuing it. Now, we are also brought to you by Trivia Revolution, which is fueled by craft beer. Trivia Revolution is a company that is spread all throughout the state of New Jersey in beer bars and breweries. And you basically can go play for free and win prizes to breweries, answer craft beer centric questions, not only, but there's a couple thrown in there. But it's just a great time. Again, that is Trivia Revolution fueled by craft beer. Now, we are lucky enough to be joined by Kazem Rashid. Kazem Rashid is just a very, very smart and educated guy. He's a human rights activist and advocate for the Muslim communities in America. He's a lawyer. He's got a big Twitter following and presence. He stands up for women's rights and Black Lives Matter and basically points out social injustices. And it was really cool to get to pick his brain and talk to him a little bit. So here's our interview with Kazem Rashid. Enjoy the podcast.
Hey, this is Kazem Rashid, and you're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun. Yeah, I mean, your shenanigans are cruel and tragic. Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Oh, hello, everybody. Welcome to Verbal Shenanigans, episode 200 and something. 224, Mike. 224.
Ooh, that's a high number there, Scotty.
It's funny because in your head, we'll be at 300 soon. You don't realize that, 300 is, you know, essentially like a year and a half away still if we do one every week, which we have done quite consistently over the last. I don't think we might have missed like 1 week all year.
I think you're pretty much correct. Yeah.
So
1 week off. So
yeah. AKA,
you know, I appreciate you giving off for my surgery. And I mean, I know you were screaming at me and talking about, I guess we're doing KiraCast too, but
The 1 week off, aka the listener's favorite episode.
Nothing says we love verbal shenanigans than a bye week.
Bye week, yeah. A audible bye. But anyway, guys, if you are just tuning in, that's Mike there. I'm Scott. And each week we basically essentially bring on an interesting guest. We have brought on everyone from Mark Summers to Trent Dilfer to hippo attack survivors, you name it, guys from Jackass, actors. You know, it's just endless at this point. I think last year, because I was looking back, we had 86 guests on last year, which is quite a lot for whatever it was, 52 episodes or something like that. 86 guests. We had a lot of double episodes. And then one of the things we're trying to do this year is do more one guest episodes. And last week we actually piled up three interviews. So we'll be spreading those out over a couple episodes in the next week or two. But
yeah, and sadly we missed our fourth one. So,
oh yeah,
which is the actual truth. And we went into it, damn, three, and then Scott said, no, let's try to beat that record,
which
sadly we couldn't.
Which reminds me, I'm definitely gonna call him in a little bit and just see if that happens. It totally reminded me. But anyway, welcome back, guys, and welcome to, if you're just listening. And yeah, that's basically the show. Last week we came, it's funny, I had three people reach out after I had posted J.S. and Dara to check out a single, and they actually checked it out. Dom, of course, was one, but two other guys, one guy I work with and one other friend, and they were like, wow, we really, like, they all fell in love with his music. So you're welcome, JS.
Yeah. Just saying.
I was just going to say that, too. So, yeah, we had JS and Dara, a guy from Nairobi, Kenya. And what we learned is that Kenya does have pizza.
Yeah, but they're smart enough not to put pineapple on it.
Yeah. But they do have pizza. I was just watching a show the other day. You had mentioned the word Amish before. It was like one of these BuzzFeed. They have like these little mini documentaries on Netflix, and they're really good. They're like little 15-minute documentaries on just like random topics. It's kind of like. Similar reminds me of the podcast a little bit, where every week is like completely different. Every episode is like, there was one on cricket, there was one on the female orgasm, there was one on, you know, all things I don't know about. So, but there was one on Amish romance novels. Apparently,
interesting.
Yes, apparently Amish romance is a huge genre of romance novels.
Is it like, since they have their dinners at candlelight or something?
Well, the way it was explained, even though I'm typing in it now, Amish romance novel is like the third thing that pops up. Explained it has like good wholesome. You should do yourself a favor, Mike, and the other, and type in Amish romance and look how many book titles pop up. Here's just a couple of them: Lydia's Charm, Plain Paradise, The Heritage of Lancaster, Amish Bride, The Bridesmaid, or A Forbidden Rumspringa, Words from the Heart, The Quilter's Daughter. but a lot
of Heritage of Lancaster County.
Yes. But the women that were explaining it, it seemed like they mostly skewed older, like an older audience. They were saying they really liked the old school values of the Amish, and that they you know, they like the love stories. Apparently, it's not like very like lusty or romantic. It's like they make like good decisions, but they're tempted to do things, and that's kind of the allure of these books.
So they just basically fall in love with them because they listen to them, is what you're saying.
I don't know. Maybe it's just like some of them were saying it's like a throwback to simpler times, and they like that. Which, I mean, I guess farming and stuff like that, I guess. Well, I just brought up 12 things we need to know about. You didn't know about Amish romance novels. So Berlo, I don't think you knew
Number
anything.
Number one, they exist.
I don't know if you – but let's. I guess we'll go through this real quick. They are called bonnet rippers. Bonnet rippers. Amish romance novels have been around since the 1970s. They acquired the nickname of bonnet rippers. But to be clear, bonnets are not literally ripped in Amish romances, at least not out of passion, out of frustration, sexual or otherwise perhaps, but never for reasons more. Or maybe a bonnet gets ripped during a buggy crash.
I feel I want to look up Urban Dictionary and put in bonnet rippers and see what they say it is. Because I got a feeling it's a tad different.
The other thing I found interesting is they're not really for Amish readers. Like, the audience is not Amish people. It's for, like, you and me.
Of course.
That could be our showdown next year. Someone's got to finish an Amish romance novel first.
Yeah. You win, Scott, again. Wow, I made it to page two. Awesome.
It'd be funny if we got someone who like was an expert of the book and we both had to read it and then they quizzed us.
The Amish romance novel book club. Verbal shenanigans.
Killing listeners all day long. So the vast majority are Christian evangelical women over the age of 40. So yeah, like I was saying, they were more of an older one, but most of them are not Amish at all. Some might be Irish, I don't know.
Many are not
written by Amish authors. Okay, most are not written by Amish authors. So this is like almost like a fantasy world. Like, they're writing about a world they're interested in, I guess. Okay.
Yeah, like this is like Aquaman if you were in Northeast Pennsylvania.
Right. Berlo, any guess as how much per year you think that the Amish romance industry is worth? How much does it generate now that you know it exists?
I originally would say $0 million, but
$0 million.
After these discussions, I'll ballpark it $240 million. Yes.
Higher, Bob.
$500.
Higher, Bob.
$720 million.
$720 million every year.
$750 million are put into these books.
Yes. According Beverly Lewis and Wanda Brunstetter, which I'm definitely writing that down to try to get them on the show.
If you didn't tell me they said it, I'd be saying you're lying, Scott.
Well, these are you learn something every day, bro. These are the two rock stars of the Amish genre, those two authors. They've sold more than 30 million books combined.
Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, just 30 million of any book these days.
Maybe that's our key in life. Just pick a group of people we know nothing about and write romance stories about them. And what was that secluded Indian island that the dude got killed at? I think I'm going to write books about them having romance.
What about man pups? That's an unexplored area.
Well, I would say Kaz Pup was the one who wrote one.
Well, he could be like your reference to write these romance novels, like to help keep it factually true.
For my book.
Mike is a good boy. For those of you who have no idea what we're talking about, not only once, but twice did we have Kazuki James, or Kaz Pup, who is a man pup. He enjoys role-playing as a dog. And Mike joined him over the years and has been going back and forth with him, doing, like, man pup, conferences,
Scott,
and things like that. So,
Scott,
on to the Amish.
You kind of went into fiction there after a while.
What do you mean? Everyone knows his name is really not Kaz Pup.
Well, I'm just saying the whole... You're right up to the point where you said, and Berlew does the following. So
Berlew,
you seem to do that with every time.
The Amish romance, it all started with The Shunning. Was the first book that got widely acclaimed in 1997. So,
oh, of course. And then they made that movie with Jack Nicholson in it. Oh, brilliant book. Brilliant book.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't know they were Amish in that book, but, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he was a Puritan who drank red rum and... you know, when his family tried to use electronics in the hotel, he was told to kill him. And then he froze to death outside. So, you know, that's what every Amish story involves.
Correct. Now, I guess this would be something that you hear romance novels and immediately you're thinking like dirty, hot Amish romance. But, Berlew, readers looking for steamy erotica that involve actual roles in the hay of Pennsylvania Dutch will be sorely disappointed. There's no sex of any kind to be found in these books. There's rarely kissing or even hand-holding. You will have to be content with longing gazes on the front porch, protagonists standing obscenely close to one another at a barn raisin, or a rebellious wisp of hair escaping from a prayer head cover.
So stalking at a farm is what you're telling me.
So
that's all we had to write about.
I guess all this is just like the anticipation of it, I guess, is really getting readers – like. You know, like if there's no action, I guess it's just maybe that slight thought of maybe it could happen. Maybe that's what keeps drawing them in. I think it sounds good. We should get the same book and read like a chapter a week and report back on the
I'd be totally down
on the podcast and discuss
it. So honest way to try to entertain our audience, but I am 100% down for this madness.
Well, we could pick one book, maybe get the most acclaimed one that we could find. We'll each order it, and you're only allowed to read a chapter per week, and we can discuss what's going on in the story and break it down from there. This has to happen.
I'd has to. I mean, this is how we're going to beat Joe Rogan. This right here.
You doing that, Joe? No. Bill Burr? What? No. Mark Maron? No.
Okay.
All right. The Amishness in Amish romances is usually minimized. Okay, so they're not written completely directly from Amish culture. Like, they take bits and pieces, but sometimes they're not really following all the exact rules.
So basically what white people do with black people, just take bits and pieces they like and steal it from them.
Right. Take their music, their culture, the movies, their comedy. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, seems right, you know.
And then give them no credit. That's usually, you forgot that part.
Exactly.
this is my favorite, Mike. Buggy crashes are a common plot device. So a buggy crash is quite often one of the main problems in the story.
Oh, man. I mean, the danger involved, the high-speed chases, the shoe fly pie that gets destroyed in the accident.
Now I may figure out, find a book that we might have to read. Subgenres of Amish romance are an emerging market. Okay, with the popularity of Amish romances becoming more and more entrenched in the book buying public, there have been several subgenres of Amish romance that have popped up. There are now Amish mystery novels and slowly gaining an audience. Young adult Amish romances are also a growing market. Berlo, they're showing me the cover of Amish Vampires in Space.
Hmm. Well, that seems just like you put a bunch of words in a bag and you took out three and like, yep, that's what we're calling it.
Yeah, and I also like, I feel like to do Amish Vampires in Space, you would need a shit ton of backstory. Like,
there's a few questions I have. Mainly how they got up there in the first place.
How are they vampires? How did Amish vampires get up there? How did vampires infect the Amish? A lot of questions.
Were the vampires on Earth and then we went to space, or were we in space and encountered vampires?
We could find out. We could find out together.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll think about that. And generally, there is a happily ever after in an anguished modern world. So generally, there is a happy ending, Berlu, just in case we do get into it and read it. Now, if we do read this book, you're not allowed to go get like cliff notes or anything. We got to read each chapter no matter how boring it is.
Well, I'm sorry, Scott. I wasn't paying attention. I'm writing my book right now, Jewish Leprechauns Underwater. Look forward to it in 2019.
Oh, well, that's great. Maybe you should write a chapter a week and also report to us.
Now you're really, really tempting me on this now. You're getting the juices flowing.
Oh, well, that's what we do here at Verbal Shenanigans. We get juices flowing. We educate you about the latest book trends, what's in the happenings in the world. But I think that's a great segue into... our guest.
No, it's not, Scott, but go on.
How exactly we're going to segue this one, I'm not sure, but I think it's guest time, Berlu.
That sounds good.
Now, a few weeks ago, I had seen some retweets from actually the lead singer of Thrice, Dustin Kentrew, who, if you go back, guys, we had the bassist and drummer on a couple weeks ago. But he was retweeting some of the tweets from a man named Kazem Rashid. Okay, and Kazem is kind of hard for me to tell you exactly what he does, because that sounds weird. Like, he's not like a secret agent or anything, but he is a Islamic activist. He is an educator. He is a women's rights defender. Black Lives Matter. He's been in a bunch of networks and does interviews, and he's just very a very proactive guy, if you say. He's got a lot of followers. He's been on a lot of different things, and I'm kind of excited to talk to him. It's definitely a different perspective that I don't think we've had on this show yet. So
basically, he's done everything that we have not.
Right.
In
right.
this world.
That makes,
like, when they make the groups of important people, he'll wave goodbye to us as he walks in the good direction.
Correct.
Gotcha.
But very smart. Very approaches things from different angles that we don't get to hear all the time, especially in our mainstream media here. So excited to talk to Kazem Rashid, and let's give him a call. So Kazem, first off, this is Scott, and that's Mike here on the other side of things. I want to thank you for coming on and give us a couple minutes here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
You're interesting for a lot of reasons, but one, it's hard to say what exactly you are first. Like, I would say, well, we got Kazem Rashid on. He's an author. He's an activist. He's a podcast host. What would you say your primary thing, or what can we call you even first?
Call me Kazem. I don't know.
I'm going to call him Duke for the entire day.
So Duke, shoot it to me straight.
No, I appreciate that. You know, I kind of keep my eyes open on areas and opportunities that I can take on to advance my mission, my message, and that's to, you know, build bridges of understanding, of dialogue, to call out injustices. Mm-hmm. And you know, being a lawyer helps, being an author helps, being active on social media helps. And so, you know, it's funny, my wife makes fun of me about this all the time too. She's like, people ask me like what you do for a living, and I don't know what to tell them.
Right, because I was even like, you know, going over our schedule. I'm like, oh, I got Kazem Rashid coming on, and you know, stop and pause. He's this, and I guess where we'll start is, you know, I had found you on Twitter. One of my one of the bands I listened to had retweeted some of your posts and liked some of your things, and I started getting into some of, you know, the posts you were writing. You write a lot about, you know, atrocities that are happening, or like you said, injustices going on around the world, especially to either Muslim people or people of color, and just injustice in general to women and whatnot. And I found a lot of your stuff very fascinating. And then I went down the wormhole into a lot of the stuff you do. And you've been on news networks, and you've done TED Talks, and you've done wrote books, and you have a podcast. So it's very hard to find a starting point, but I guess the starting point would be like, Where did you start developing this voice for seeking out injustice and seeking out equal rights, or active talking about equal rights? Now, obviously, you're a Muslim man. Did you face a lot of adversity, or still do, or did this come from a place where you are trying to more focus on helping others that you've seen go through these things?
Yeah, I mean, it's a combination of the two. You know, there's the, I don't want to call it cliche, but the common story of American Muslims, of where they were when 9/11 happened and how the world changed after that.
Right.
And so that's a part of it. But I think for me, the main motivator, while that was obviously a significant and horrible event for any number of reasons that, you know, we can have a whole podcast on. For me, the moment that I realized something is severely wrong and needs to change, and I write about this in my first book, The Wrong Kind of Muslim, was when I, as an adult, went back to Pakistan to visit family. It was the first time in my adult life I'd gone back. It had been well over a decade. This was 2005, 2006. I was, you know, maybe 23 years old. And I visited a mosque not far from my grandfather's ancestral home. And this mosque had been attacked by the Taliban just a few weeks prior. And it was attacked because the mosque was it belonged to my particular community of Muslims, the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. And we faced pretty heavy persecution in Pakistan, up to and including capital punishment, simply for our belief.
Right.
And this was a mosque that the Taliban had targeted and killed 8 people and injured like 25, 30 more. And walking into that mosque and seeing the bullet holes and the blood splattered carpets that were still there, and talking to the parents of those who had been killed, one of the kids that had been killed was only 16 years old. A couple of thoughts went through my mind that this horrible thing has happened, and there's not a single person I know outside of my own, you know, small circle, mm-hmm, that's even aware of what's happening. And that bothered me, that this horrible atrocity happened and people are totally oblivious to it. And then the very next thing was, well, this is ridiculous. Why isn't somebody telling this story? And then you can guess what happened next. The very next thing that crossed my mind was, well, why the hell aren't you telling the story? What's stopping you? And so that kind of it helped me. It was a kick in the teeth for sure.
Right.
But it helped me kind of reflect for a moment that, you know, here I am living in the United States. I've got, you know, I just graduated from college. I have literally access to anything I want to do. I can travel anywhere. I can do anything. And I can't even tell my own story. How can I expect other people to? So that is what really, you know, everything coalesced, and I kind of looked over my history and my youth and, you know, the profiling I've experienced and thought, okay, I can either sit here and complain and play the victim, or I can be proactive and assertive and do what I can to help make a positive change. And, you know, I, as far as I can tell, I haven't really done much yet. I've taken maybe one or two baby steps. I've got a long way to go, but I'm going to keep pushing. I'm going to keep striving. That's what jihad means. So, you know, keep striving forward for peace and justice. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Tell us about your first couple steps and all. What was your thought process going into it? Like, were you thinking, okay, I'm going to go on Twitter and just lay out some information. I'm going to have a community thing to talk about stuff. What was your first steps and what did you learn from getting the word out?
So it was none of those things. It was trying to figure out, how do I prepare myself to even speak coherently and competently on these issues? One of the things that we've seen, especially over the last several years, is the rise of the Google Scholar. Someone who read some article on some uber liberal or uber conservative website,
no,
and suddenly they know everything there is to know about them. So, you know, I didn't want to be that guy. And so for me, you know, for my first book, The Wrong Kind of Muslim, you know, I traveled to Pakistan, to India, to Thailand, to the UK, to Canada, multiple times. And it was a total of 6 or 7 trips, totaling, you know, about 8 months of traveling over a period of 3 years, to interview people, to meet with them, and to document authentically. Before I began speaking about international human rights in law school, I studied under international human rights professors and scholars and wrote my thesis on international human rights law. And a particular subject of it, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And so everything that I would speak about, I would make sure that I was grounded in scholarship and in reality. I would learn from the scholars who were already doing it. I would learn from people who were already working in that space. When I wanted to get into combating domestic and sexual violence, I learned from lawyers who are working in the space for decades and were very good at what they do, and they have the track record to prove it. So so that's what I really focus my attention on, that if I'm going to speak on something, I'm not going to speak from a position of ignorance or from a position of being a populist. I want to speak from a position of authenticity, of facts, of experience.
Right.
And so the rest of the stuff, the Twitter stuff, the Facebook stuff, I really have no care for it. I don't enjoy being on social media. Contrary to what people think, it's the only reason I'm on social media is because it's a means to communicate a message. If there was a better way, I would find that better way. But you know, you can talk to my wife, you can talk to my friends. I'm actually I prefer the privacy that comes with not having to have a public profile, but It's kind of that balance that if I do that, then I miss out on a lot of opportunities to help elevate the reality of injustices and try to bring about change. So for me, that's how I try to disseminate the knowledge that I've been fortunate enough to learn and keep learning.
Now, do you find it hard to – now, seeing a lot of your interviews and just hearing you talk, you bring things into a very – it seems you try to put a very positive – preach positivity and point out injustice without anger. And I'd watched one of your the talks, and you had talked about feeding the trolls, I believe was the expression you used, and you know, fighting people almost with logic. And you did this fascinating thing where you had talked to, I believe his name was Nate. He was this Nazi that messaged you these horrific things and obviously extremely bigoted things. How have you, one, do you try to, is that a conscious approach you try to do? And is it hard to keep that focus and that calm and that smart, you know, civil discourse when people are saying horrific things to you? And two, has that helped you kind of spread to people without, I know there's been controversy around you, which I don't really understand why, but is that like the whole focus, is to try to remain positive, remain educated, remain, you know, open for discussion?
Well, it goes back to my philosophy of collateral education, that the person that I'm responding to may or may not learn or care to learn, but there's people watching that will. And that I've seen proven time and time again. I have, you know, on a daily basis, I get messages and emails of people saying that, look, I actually had a fear of Muslims, but after seeing how you responded to that person who was, you know, vitriolic or violent, I'm beginning to realize I need to reevaluate the way I look at things. And I've had this, I mean, this is an ongoing thing. And so for me, that's the victory I'm looking for. And then every so often, you have something else really powerful happen. I tweeted about this just yesterday, but a couple of months ago, a Republican politician made some really nasty anti-Muslim remarks. And I responded in a thread. I didn't attack him. I just attacked his remarks and showed why his remarks were wrong. And it was a really productive thread. It went viral. And, you know, he blocked me. And I thought, well, you know, that's his choice. But, you know, people will respond how they want to. And in the meantime, I had literally thousands of people responding positively. Well, lo and behold, a couple of days ago, I get a private message from someone. It's this candidate, this Republican politician, saying, hey, I just want to apologize. What I said was wrong, and the way I acted was wrong. And if you're willing to have a dialogue, I'd love to chat. We spoke on the phone for 30 minutes, and now we're texting and trying to find ways to have interfaith events and you know, bridge that gap that's formed. So
that's great.
I try to keep positive because I firmly believe that, you know, we need to keep the doors open even when it's difficult. You know, it's you know, you ask if it's difficult, and yeah, it can be, especially when you're expected to be the martyr. But the way I look at it is, I would rather err on the side of compassion and positivity, and just remember that my goal is not a short term victory, but a long-term victory. And that long-term victory happens when you follow the examples of, you know, for me, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, who suffered for 20 years of brutal persecution. And when he retook Mecca, it was peacefully. And he gave amnesty to all the people persecuting and killing him and his family members. I mean, for me, there's no more powerful example of mercy than that. And so if he can do that, I can definitely be kind to somebody mean on Twitter.
Right.
So. Apples and oranges, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, when you're working with people of different faiths, one thing I've always kind of noticed, I kind of find it interesting, as your career as an attorney in the law, as they say, it's kind of the letter of the law. What's in the books is what is in essence a law, where I see sometimes some people who may be over religious kind of go the same way, like, this is what it says in the Bible, so by rule I should be like this. Have you ever like faced people who like are very to the bone, this is what's in there, this is my belief, and had to like discuss with them, you know, how to bring them together for peace, if you will?
You know, there's no one playbook. It's more of an art than a science, and the art becomes easier when you understand the science. I think, you know, there's two kinds of people that I think are dangerous when they're around scripture. Those that have only a little bit of knowledge, And those who have knowledge, but they're incentivized by money. And the people who have a little bit of knowledge will cherry pick the parts they like or don't like, or the parts that benefit them, and ignore the parts that don't benefit them, and use that to manipulate and or be manipulated. And you see that whether it's somebody being radicalized by you know, someone like Osama bin Laden, or somebody, you know, being radicalized like you know, these white supremacists or these KKK members who claim that they're Christian. You know, these people don't actually know what the Bible says or what the Quran says, but they have a little bit of knowledge and a lot of anger, and they manipulate. And then the other side are people who are incentivized by money. And so you've got these clerics and these priests and these ministers and these mullahs who it's in their best interest to keep people ignorant and keep the propaganda going, and because that's their bread and butter. And so my job is to use knowledge and to use a proven model of my faith to say that what I'm advocating isn't theory. It's not this pie in the sky idea. It's a demonstrable example of what Islam teaches. Just as a because I'm Muslim, let me just pick on Islam. But this is a demonstrable example of what Islam teaches. It's not something that's my opinion that I just made up. I can show you as a living model that this works. And if you want to refute me, then you have to show me a better model. I don't want your opinion. I don't want your commentary. I don't want your guess. Show me a better model. And if you can't, or if you need to resort to force or violence, then you've already lost, because truth doesn't need force to back it up. Truth simply needs the fact that it's self-evident. And that model has worked really well for me. It's worked really effectively for me. And it's allowed me to push back against, you know, the fundamentalists and the bigots and the people who, you know, will take a message in the wrong way. I mean, the Quran, for example, in chapter 3, verse 8 and 9, says two really profound things. One, it says that you have to accept the whole book. You can't cherry pick. You need to accept the entire book. So there's no cafeteria Quran here. And two, it says that there are certain verses that are interpretive and others that are decisive. And the people who have a diseased heart, who have a perverted heart, look for the violent interpretation. So it preemptively calls out people who try to find violent interpretations where none exist. It calls them perverted. Right. So, you know, so for me, it's a pretty clear cut example. And the funny thing is, when I point this out to people who are trying to find a valid interpretation, they don't have an answer because they're perverted, and there's no answer to that. So
I mean, there's a lot we could delve in. Now, you, how do you feel towards, you know, it seems like almost every religion, especially people who are very old school and refuse to evolve, very often exclude women's rights, and very often exclude homosexuals' rights. And how do you find, you know, being a very progressive guy and also, but, you know, somewhat traditional, how do you find the reaction is from what we could call the older guard towards you, or the what you call maybe like clerics and things like that? Do you get a lot of pushback when you address those types of issues?
Well, you know, I would say that I'm not a progressive or a conservative.
Right.
You know, Islam is a religion inherently based on moderation.
Right. When I mean progressive, I kind of mean more, you know, speaking of terms that are or issues that are very, you know,
but
now.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from, but let me put my comment in broader context so your listeners understand that I'm not trying to avoid labels. I'm just trying to, you know, that even these concepts of progressive and liberalism, they change over time. So yeah. I'll give you one good example, right? When the first imam of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, the first missionary, arrived in the United States in 1920, he established the first mosque, and this was in Jim Crow America. And he established a mosque where we have documented, we have pictures and everything, that there was Black Americans, White Americans, Latino Americans, men and women worshiping together, side by side.
Right.
And in Jim Crow America, this was considered out of this world. This was, I mean, super uber liberal, this was, you know, far left liberal thinking. It was unheard of, right? But now we look at that and say, well, that's pretty standard. That's pretty basic common sense. And if you don't do that, then you're pretty much insane. And likewise, where, you know, the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, when it comes to LGBT rights, says, well, you know, we still uphold traditional marriage between men and women, but we're also on the record saying that just because somebody is gay doesn't mean that they should be mistreated or given discriminatory treatment or denied human rights. Or, you know, if somebody is gay and they want to come to our mosque, they're most welcome to. No one's going to deny them or stop them. They will be treated with the same love and respect as any human being is, because they're human beings and they deserve basic love and respect. Now, you know, that right there, some people, if this was 30 years ago, that would have been deemed uber liberal. And now some people say, well, it's still too conservative because you're not fully embracing gay marriage. So it's all a perspective,
right?
But it's on a spectrum. And so, you know, what we would say is that we have a pretty consistent platform that has withstood the test of time. And that's what I mean by a proven model. This is, you know, this view that we've had on combating racism isn't something that we, you know, woke up to in 1978 like the Mormon Church did, not to pick on them, but just as one example.
Mm-hmm.
It's a view we've had for 1400 years, right? And so, you know, the old guard, so to speak, that pushed back are the fundamentalists that I'm talking about. They're the ones that are financially incentivized to keep the status quo. And I'll give you one very good example of that. In countries like Pakistan, where they have anti-blasphemy laws, there's this, you know, a Christian woman, Asia Bibi, who was just fortunately exonerated from alleged blasphemy. She was on death row. Now, we're being accused of being liberal because we say she should never have gone to prison in the first place. And yeah, but the old guard in their fundamentalist mentality know that their bread and butter, their financial incentive, is to keep people under control. So that's why they wanted her to be killed. And so, yes, it pushes back, but our response to them is with education and with a proven model. And frankly, you know, it's a long battle, but we're definitely winning the hearts and minds, and that's what we're ultimately after.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. When I've looked over that you've been on various different networks and all, from like CNN and Fox News, and I've watched a few videos. When you go on there, do you look forward to actual debate, or when you arrange going on to the shows, are you more trying to push towards, hey, let's just have a conversation versus this is Muslim, this is Christian, this is that?
Yeah, it depends on the outlet. I mean, if it's a certain right wing outlet, I know I'm going to get, you know, 8 seconds, if that, before I get cut off. So you have to get your message out quickly. If it's another outlet like a CNN or, you know, or an NBC, I'll typically get more time to actually have a conversation and talk. Or if it's an outlet like you guys, we can actually have a conversation and you know, debate ideas. I've been on podcasts done by atheists, and we've debated religion and God, and I loved it because it was an actual, you know, healthy debate of ideas, and we disagreed vehemently, but we were respectful of one another as people. So it depends on the outlet, but, you know, the strategy changes depending on who you're talking to.
Now, you do so many different things, and like I said, we could have you on for two more hours easily. But you host a podcast called Recite Islam. Tell people who are listening a little bit about that.
Well, we started the podcast Recite Islam because we wanted to ask people to take a second look at what you've been told Islam is, and hence recite. And so far, it's been a lot of fun and extraordinarily successful. Our season one ended at the start of October. Season two is launching tomorrow, actually. And for the majority of season one, we were the number one Islam podcast on iTunes.
Sweet.
Which was awesome. Yeah.
We were going for that market, but we missed the mark.
Yeah.
But after today.
Hey, we're... Do it, man. More power to you guys.
No, and, go ahead.
And the podcast is a story format. We literally tell a story every single episode. So it's not us preaching. It's not evangelizing. And it's not like a boring lecture. It literally is a story embedded in the history of Islam, and we share lessons based on what the actual history is, because again, going back to this concept of it being a proven model. And what's cool is that, yeah, we have a lot of Muslim listeners, but we have a ton of atheist, agnostic, Christian. I have Trump supporters emailing me that they love the podcast. So it's a really exciting way to connect with people and show just how similar we really are.
Interesting. Now, we've had a really serious conversation here. So we are Verbal Shenanigans. For what I've heard from another podcast, you're apparently a great dad joke teller. So I'm wondering if you can give us a good dad joke here before we let you go tonight.
Well, the thing about my dad jokes, and I really don't know how to explain this, but I don't actually spend time thinking about my dad jokes.
They're natural.
They just kind of come to me. So like the other day, I said to my wife, you know, there's a breed of dog that gets sad if you feed it cantaloupe. And she's like, that's the most random fact I've ever heard. What breed? And I said, melancholy. And see? And like, mm-hmm. And so she did a face palm and she walked out. And you know, and it's one of those things where you can't really just predict it. It just as soon as it comes to your lips, you got to kind of let it out. Like another one was, I said to her, but there's actually a medical term for when your foot falls asleep. And thinking I was serious, she said, what? And I said, comatose. And yeah, you know.
Wow. All right.
Scott, book this guy on Tap House 15 immediately.
I mean, I could see you, you know. You are definitely very well educated in many things, including terrible jokes. So,
you know, the dad jokes are honestly for my own sanity, because I do tweet about a lot of heavy stuff. And so for me, it lets me kind of remember that, hey, you have to laugh a lot too. That's what life is all about.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
That's our motto here. Kazem, if people want to check you out, you have a wealth of, like I said, this interview, so many different things. What's a good place to kind of, for people to go, not only to see your stuff, but to get more of a general idea of who you are, and then they can kind of be redirected into all the different things you do. What's the best place for them to go?
I mean, you know, my website, KazemRashid.com. I post a lot of articles and stories on there. You know, I'm on Twitter at MuslimIQ. And check out our podcast at Recite Islam, R-E-S-I-G-H-T, Islam, one word. And check us out. And I'm pretty good at responding to DMs if I'm not traveling. But I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to get your thoughts on the podcast too.
That's awesome. I want to thank you so much for coming on. I'd love to get you on in the future again. You're one of those voices that's very, very important, represents a lot of different things, and doesn't fit the round hole. You know, what am I trying to say? The round thing doesn't fit in the square hole or whatever it is. But you are the breaking the stereotypes and things that we need. You remind me very much of a guest we've had on a couple of times named Tom Verney, who is a former NYPD detective, but he's also a gay man, but he's also he's very interesting and touches on many different things. And I think you bring that very important message too. And you are looking at things that people are sometimes afraid to look at. So I think you're doing great work, and thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate that.
So, Berlu, it just goes to show you never we never quite figure this show out. We go from Amish romance, unplanned Amish romance, which may start something on this show. Maybe a fun bit we can carry over into the new year. And then we talk to a guy who is actually doing like real work and improving humanity and trying to get that, you know, education out there, not like us, Kazem Rashid. So just you get a little bit of everything on the show. You get a little taste of everything.
Yeah, you get a little taste of everything. And much like pineapple on a pizza, it doesn't really work out all the time.
I told you, I admitted last week, there comes a point in time where a man must admit defeat. And I have decided to open the pizza place in Nairobi, like you said.
Yep.
I'm searching for properties as we speak. Dirt cheap. So, bro, you got anything before we go?
Well, I just got back from vacation and all, and I kind of I come to the realization I lived the life of remember the episode of Seinfeld where Kramer retired and he went down to the old folks community?
Yes.
That was like my great week I just had over down in Okeechobee.
Didn't Jerry go down to the old folks home too?
Well, he went. Yeah, I mean, he went down there for a few episodes, but he just happened to go down there. He's like, Kramer, what are you doing here? I think he got his money from the coffee table book. So.
Yeah. Speaking of, real quick before you get into that, I think if you are a Seinfeld fan, you might be pretty happy with a guest coming up in the next like 2 or 3 weeks from now. A little hint there, but don't worry. It's not George or Kramer or Jerry or Elaine, but...
don't set your heights too high now, people. This is Verbal Shenanigans.
but it is is in the Seinfeld world. I think people will be happy to hear that. But anyway, continue.
Well, we were down there this past week for the holiday. We busy, and we were going around doing all the activities of the place, and it just everybody was like so happy I was there and everything, and all, and I was just like dominating stuff. Meanwhile, it's like I'm beating like a 60-70 year old and stuff, and but it's still making me happy and everything,
right?
Yeah, so like for example that we were playing water volleyball, and I was just like I was just kicking it, and I wasn't like spiking or anything, but I was making like the big saves and everything like that. I was playing the back line and doing those like jump dives where you're like flying back in the water and you're just like slapping it at before it hits the water in the last second, and everybody's like, oh.
So
feeling good about
it. So you're
life.
Telling me you were creating a highlight reel at an old people's retirement volleyball game in the water.
Yeah. Okay.
So basically you're making up for like all the crappy IT soccer teams. Now you're thinking you're like the big guy on campus at the retirement home.
Well, the funny thing was, like, as you kind of mentioned that, like, I think I even sent to you, like, I got a thing on Facebook reminders talking about like the 9-year anniversary of one of our rare wins. I actually couldn't show up for the game because of work and all, but I like tagged all the people in it, and even the people involved with the team are all like, man, I don't remember us winning. When the hell did that happen? More and more people were tagging other players, and they were all still like, when that happened? I don't remember that. Was I there?
We won. I'm sorry. But, so you're killing it at the retirement center. Got it.
Yeah, and then later my dad showed me the game of pickleball.
Ah, yes, pickleball's awesome. Very big in that community.
Yeah, have you ever played it before or know about it?
Yes, I have played one time. There's a little pickleball court down the shore. Down by Point Pleasant.
So
we messed around a little bit. But I have friends who go down to LBI, and they go away for a week every year, and they play like every single morning with like all the old people there, and there's like tournaments every day and stuff like that.
Yeah, so for people who don't know what this is, it's basically a full court table tennis game. Not in the sense of regular tennis, but it's kind of like table tennis where the ball is kind of like a wiffle ball, if you will. They have it's kind of shaped like a tennis racket, but it's not open. I don't know, but it's almost looks like a spatula, if you will. It doesn't have strings. It's a flat board, and basically you serve it over. It has to bounce once, so you serve it over to the other side. It's got to bounce once, and then the game is fully open, kind of like tennis, where you can hit it anywhere. So
yep.
My dad was teaching me that. We played a quick game, and then some of the locals who were there who actually played for a while came over, and we did a team game where I helped out. And, you know, I was getting a lot of good job, Mike, and all that stuff.
It'd be funny if you were like, they let you be like the water boy and help them towel them off while they're playing.
A Legend of Bagger Vance kind of thing. So, serve to the left side.
I'm getting oily over here, Mike. Where are you? Yes, sir.
And so then at nights we were playing Patonk. And like that, you're giving a weird look.
Yeah, I don't know that one.
It's kind of like Canadian bocce ball. It's kind of the same premise where you throw out a small little ball. They call it a pig, and they have it like on a sand lot. It's flattened out, so it's a solid course. But instead of underhand throwing like you do at bocce, you have these metal balls and you throw it kind of overhand, kind of flick it with the wrist. And it's the same concept where you try to get the balls closest to the small ball, and everyone on your team, for every close ball you have directly of your team, you get a point, and it's a 13.
What is this called? Badunkadunk? What is it called again?
Patonk.
Patonk.
P-O-N-T-O-Q-U-E, I want to say, is the spelling.
Like Patonka.
Yeah.
He was my favorite wrestler, Patonka.
Yeah. Patonka, dun 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 dun. Buffalo, dun dun dun. You gotta play that for the audience one of these days.
I will. I'll have to break that down.
I know that we're getting a little sidetracked, but basically, as Scott has said, Patonka is his favorite wrestler. I found like the absolute worst WWF album ever, where Patonka had a song. And he talks about like being a Native American or that all spoken word that just out of blue is like Tatanka dun da dun 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 Buffalo dun da dun da dun dun Tatanka dun da dun da dun 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 Buffalo. And just that was like the kick of the song.
I thought it was poetic personally, but
yeah.
Yeah.
It really represents a Native American community well.
Oh.
Is it like their Amish romance?
Well, you're a Redskin fan, I mean that doesn't represent them too well.
Well, for what?
Did you see the Indians? No more Chief Wahoo.
Yeah.
You guys are holding on.
Good old Dan Snyder. last I heard, like I was watching a debate on First Take. One of them brought up that apparently the Redskins are like the number one team of Native Americans according to some studies.
Well, of course they are.
Yeah.
They got cool arrows and they got Native American stuff, so you know they're gonna still like them. They might not love the name, but what are they gonna like? The dolphins?
Great white dolphins have wonderful run game.
All right. So anyway, back to your retirement.
Yeah. So they made me. Lead thrower on that, so I got to throw out the pig and then do like the first throws. And it took me a little while, but I finally started getting the hang of it, and I was pointing for the team. So, you know, I just feel like I'm a multi-sport retirement athlete, and I don't know how to make my money off of that.
So what you're saying is you're ready, you're in your prime now, but by the time retirement comes, you're just going to be one of them.
Yeah, exactly. If I don't bring it to the next level, you know, it will never come.
Now, how can we get you to retire earlier? Like, you're going to need some kind of get-rich scheme quick.
Well, I was hoping our sponsors were going to help me out.
Yes. Yes.
Trivia Nation.
And Burla,
Trivia Revolution.
Burla's retirement brought by Wolf Nation.
Well, I mean, that's the purest form of waking up and living free.
Oh, well. All right.
There you go. There's your segue.
So did you just hang out at the retirement club the whole time, or?
For the most part. I mean, on the last day, we ran down to Disney Springs the girl could get her Disney-nerd on.
What the hell is Disney Springs? Is that like a
Disney
like
Springs
a ghetto
is
Disney?
Kind of like a, it's basically a shopping mall slash entertainment center that's, you know, bought by that's owned by Disney. So they have tons of restaurants. They have different stores to shop in. They have some entertainment centers. I know the NBA Experience is coming there next year. So. It's basically if Disney owned a strip mall and made it Disney.
That sounds like one of the first layers of hell from the Halloween special.
It wasn't that bad. I mean, the good part is you can spend the day there, say you're at Disney, and not spend $200 for being there, if you will.
I've never even heard of that. Disney Springs.
I think it's fairly recent. I don't know exactly when it started. I even know when I went there with Izzy the first time, I was kind of like, what the hell are you taking me to? What was I going to say? They had a festival of Christmas trees where they dressed up a bunch of Christmas trees like different Disney properties.
The two things that your wife obsesses over combined in one.
Yeah. It was a walking orgasm for her, is what I'm basically saying. I was just gonna say,
you've tried to give her the old walking orgasm, but none of your methods seem to.
Keeps on screwing up the second I walk in the room. I don't understand, Scotty.
That's why she's always limping around. The walking orgasm didn't work?
Nah, man.
I
tried the running start orgasm. She really did not appreciate that. She had the gynecologist right now.
She slipped a disc. It's bad. But
so I mean, some of them they did quality on, but it was kind of funny. Like, I'll have to send you like a picture of like Star Wars. All they did was get like bulbs and like put like a Wookiee outfit on top of them or something like that. Where it's like, yo, you're Disney and that's Star Wars. You cheaped out on that?
Yuck. What are you gonna do? But I guess it's time to get out of here. I think we gotta up and roll. We have plenty of content here, so let's not bore the listeners any more minutes.
Oh, Scott, but I love boring the audience. It's what I do best, which is what you tell me all the time.
Amish romance novel, page one. But, Berlo, anything to promote before we get on out of here?
I will promote our friends, the Dumb Fellas. They've been putting out new content as of late, you know, with Natty Bumper Car, KP Burke, Kevin Garifo, McDonald and Carney. They're talking about times on the road, different conversations about comedy and on stage and everything. They're good guys. Check them out on your podcast viewing pleasure, Dumb Fellas.
I don't like those guys. I don't like them at all.
Not a single one of them?
Nah. Dislike. Mucho dislike-o.
Like, if you had to rank them from least favorite to favorite, how would you go?
Oh, Natty would be last place. Natty Bumper Car.
That makes sense. He's the biggest asshole of the group. Continue.
Yeah. I would do, KP Burke, he's a pile of crap.
Nothing original about that guy.
Garifo, Rich and Joe, they could all be solid. I would put Pig number one. Pig. Yeah.
That makes sense. I mean, Natty's an asshole, but Pig, he's a good guy. Check out our podcast where we unfortunately listen as Natty Bumper Car, but listen to Pig.
Yeah. And I'm going to have to promote, again, I am promoting a show on December 29th in Kingston, New York, at the Art Society of Kingston, or ASK. Me and Jimmy McDonald, we are, I guess, technically co-headlining. So I'm going to be, if you guys are anywhere in the New York area, not New York City, in the upstate New York area, I'm going to be doing about 30 minutes there. So that should be fun. Kind of excited about it. Nice. So that is the Art Society of Kingston. You can get tickets now. They are $15. All right. I want to thank Kazim Rashid and our also very talented Amish writers for generating such thrilling conversation. And Berlo, I'll see you next week. But the rest of you guys, I hope I hear from you guys. Make sure you follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and download the episodes, comment on them, share them. That really helps populate it and get it out to ears that need to hear it. Guys, life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back.
As I walk through the valley where I harvest my grain, I take a look at my wife and realize she's very plain. But that's just perfect for an Amish like me. You know I shun fancy things like electricity. At 4:30 in the morning, I'm milking cows. Jebediah feeds the chickens and Jacob plows. Fool, and I've been milking and plowing so long that even Ezekiel thinks that my mind is gone. I'm a man of the land, I'm into discipline. Got a Bible in my hand and a beard on my chin. But if I finish all of my chores and you finish thine, then tonight we're gonna party like it's 1699. We've been spending most on...